You are Locked On Knicks, your daily podcast on the New York Knicks. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Shot blocked. Porzingis with his fourth projection. Courtney Lee for three. Beasley lines up. Ntilikina.
What he does is contagious. He comes in, touches.
And across the lane. Baker launches. Jack to Porzingis. Fires up the ball.
Welcome, everybody, to Locked On Knicks, the podcast that's in the 99th percentile of explaining, complaining, and entertaining. I'm your host, James Mastina, a.k.a. Mortadella Vadova. You, my name is NBA Injury Report on Twitter. And this is episode 337. Woo! It's a lot of souths! On today's show, we are joined by the wonderful Jeffrey Ballone. You may know him as Nick Film School on Twitter. You may also know him as JB. He goes by so many names. And we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. We're going to talk about summer workout videos, that controversial topic. We're going to talk about some salary cap questions that have come up over the past couple weeks. We're going to talk about JB's history as Nick's Film School, where he came from, where he's going with this project. We're going to talk about the recording artist Blood Orange for a couple minutes. And then we're going to close out by discussing how good the Knicks can be, realistically, this coming year. First time having Nick's Film School on the pod. Excited to have him on. I think you guys will enjoy the conversation. Let's just do it, right? Why am I delaying it anymore when I could just stop right this very moment and just let you hear the conversation? But I just gotta extend it. Why? You know, it's a question for the ages, really. I think Socrates...
Hit it, Marv!
Yes!
All right, we're in the off-season. One of the staples of the off-season is summer workout videos. Some people hate them. Some people love them, I assume. You post a ton of them, JV, as you go about your daily life as Nick's Film School. What do you make of summer workout videos? What do they mean to you?
To me, they mean content in the off season. But no, you know, that's the funny part about it, right? I mean, I think if people follow my account, they see I like to just put pretty much anything that goes on with the Knicks out there. And when the team doesn't make the playoffs and it's mid-April, the season's over, and we literally have a six-month off season, you know, to me at the start, it's always, okay, here's actually guys on the Knicks playing basketball. So that beats maybe my just opinion on the team. But funny enough, and you can give your thoughts on it, I've started to learn that actually, I think people rather just get, you know, a text tweet than see, you know, Cantor doing another, you know, layup in an empty gym.
Do you get positive feedback? Because I mean, the way that the internet is, it tends to be in any field, no matter what you're talking about, the more negative people are a little bit louder, you know, like most people who are generally okay with something don't go on Twitter to be like, you know, I'm perfectly okay with this, but they go on when they're furious. So do you get positive feedback, or people like, nice, I like to see, you know, Trey Burke on the grind or whatever?
Yeah. No, that's actually probably the biggest thing I'm grateful for with my account is everyone complains about their Twitter mentions. And it's not to say I don't have the occasional person that says anything, but I'm actually really surprised, like, how many people, like, even when they want to criticize something, they'll have this big intro like, hey, man, I love what you're doing. I really think it's awesome. But there's this one thing I don't like. And I'm always like, just come at me. You don't have to preface it with the big thing. You know?
Yeah, it's all about just how you phrase stuff, because you're not going to agree with anyone 100% of the time on anything. But if you can not phrase things like a huge dick right off the bat, then that's fine. You can disagree.
And, yep, exactly.
Yeah. So you're not posting these with the intention of like, oh man, we're learning so much about this person and they're going to kill it next year because they're working harder than anyone else. It's content.
Exactly. It's content. And I've tried to say where I can, like, you know, I think Moutier is maybe the good example. For most of the offseason, he didn't really post much other than like strange pictures of like him randomly like sitting around pool furniture was one of them. Like, yeah. There were really some interesting shots. Or one of them was like him in a, it looked like an empty office building on a wooden desk, and he just like has his feet up.
He's in a boiler room somewhere making some extra scratch.
Like, where does this come from? So because of that, I understand that the perception could be, okay, people see another player, like say Tim Hardaway Jr. always in the gym, and Moutier always in a strange place, so one player is working harder. But, you know, I try to put out there at least to explain to people, you know, this is just what we see. Different guys have, remember, a lot of these guys might have an agent or their agency who posts a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, they just might have a better PR section that is able to do it. So that's why I don't take too much out of it, because you just don't know.
Yeah, and I got to imagine the vast majority of these guys just have very regimented workout routines throughout the summer. Like, they've got a plan. You know, they're professionals. They're paying people however much they're paying to help them get ready. Like, it would just be more surprising to me if I assume everyone is working pretty hard. You know, there might be like this Kobe level of work, you know, so to speak, yep, that's a cut above. But these guys are all, you know, you don't waltz into the NBA by accident. You're working your ass off. Like, around the clock.
Right, right. They're professional. I mean, the thing that, and funny enough, maybe a common friend, Brian Giberman, we talked about this a little on Twitter a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm, is I think there's a post, it was like a late night workout with Trey Burke and Frank working together. And, you know, everyone kind of got excited because it's like, oh, here's two guys, they're competing for the same spot, and now they're working together. And I think Brian's valid point was, well, you know, they're on the same team. There's a lot of restrictions about what you can do, you know, formally with the team. So these players find ways to work together. But that said, with the Knicks, I think what is maybe a little different is not so much the work ethic, but the type of players they have on a roster. So by the fact that they have a lot of young players, mm-hmm, who are, you know, I know they like to keep a lot of players in the White Plains area. They're just kind of hanging out, so they're more likely to maybe do something together at a random time of day versus a veteran who's, you know, back, you know, with their family in whatever city they decided to live in off season, or, you know, so some of it just might be a product of that more than it is showing that these guys are working harder than other guys. It's just they might be closer in proximity for longer points at off season.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And with that, I think I've exhausted any thoughts I could possibly have.
Yeah, videos. Right. We've had enough seeing this, so we don't need to talk about it.
It is one of those things, though. It just keeps propping up, and the awesome people are like, why is this shit even up there? And it's like, look, dude, you don't have to read it, or you don't have to watch it if you don't like it. But there's nothing going on right now. So just wanted to touch on that for a moment. I want to talk about some salary cap questions that have come up this offseason. But before we do that, just want to remind our listeners that you guys are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. All right, so the salary cap. The salary cap, it's a sore subject for me. It's not even remotely why I got into basketball in the first place. But it is basically the framework for everything that happens around team building. It's incredibly important and informs every decision that a team must make because there is a salary cap. And I can really only stomach talking about it with another person. I can't do it like alone on my podcast. I need some human element brought into this equation. And since you're here and you are so good with salary cap stuff, JB, I was hoping that I could pose a couple questions to you that have floated around out there one way or another, and which I think you've answered a lot on Twitter, but now we're going to do it in podcast form. And that first question is, can the Knicks free up enough cap space for Kevin Durant next offseason? And if so, what would that look like?
Right. So, I mean, I guess all these questions get tied back to Noah and what the team decides to do with him. Mm-hmm. So there's two ways of looking at it. One is, can they free up enough cap space for a max slot? And again, the max slot, it depends how much years a player has played in the league. So if you've played 7 to 9 years in the league, your max slot is a different percentage than if you played 10 plus, or if you played 0 to 6 years. But the point is, for the Knicks to have enough room to make max space, and why reaching a buyout agreement and stretching Noah has some attraction perhaps to them, is they could literally create that max space without doing anything other than stretching Noah, waiving Lance Thomas, and renouncing all of their current free agents. So meaning like someone like Cantor, they wouldn't, you know, bring back. They would have to essentially forfeit the bird rights they have on him and let him go, and that frees up space. So to answer your question, yes, they can create max space. How they go about doing it is more of the, you know, the scenario planning and whether or not they need to move a player like a Courtney Lee or not. That kind of all depends on, you know, really what they do with Noah first.
So you said that you mentioned they had to renounce all their free agents most likely to free up that max space. I mean, like, how realistic is there a scenario in which they're like, you know what, even though we could free up space for Kevin Durant, we're not going to do it because then we'll have four guys on the roster? Is that possible? Or is that just a matter of there's enough exceptions and things of that nature and minimum contracts that they would just, you know, in addition to their young guys in KP, they would just be like, yeah, we're going to sign Durant, assuming they were so lucky that he wanted to sign with the Knicks, and then have six guys on the roster who are minimum dudes or whatever.
Well, I guess he's an interesting one because I couldn't remember now exactly how long he's been in the league, but I think by next summer he would already be a 10-plus year veteran.
Yeah, that's right.
So meaning he would require a larger percentage of the cap. So I think for someone like Kyrie, who I think is still in that 7 to 9 year, they can do it while keeping, for instance, all their young players. So your point of, you know, would they only have like three or four guys on a roster? I mean, they could literally have their entire roster that, you know, they could have Tim Hardaway Jr., Courtney Lee, KP, Frank, Knox, all those guys, and still create space to sign a player like Kyrie. I think if with Durant, there's enough difference with the percentage of his max, and I know he's proven in Golden State that he's willing to take less, that they might have to forfeit, you know, another player to make the requisite space.
Yeah.
But to me, what is attractive about 2019 and what appears to be the team's plan that's different than in the past is all of these cap scenarios are based on keeping the young core. So it's not like, you know, we're going to trade everyone for Melo. That's the baggage everyone has. It's like, no, this is saying we're going to have KP. We're going to have Knox. We're going to have Frank. We're just also going to have cap and Mitchell Robinson. We're just going to also have cap space to add to them.
This is something that came up on the podcast the other day. Is there any scenario where they could free up enough for Kyrie and Jimmy Butler, who are, you know, rumored obviously to want to play together, maybe for the Knicks? Or is that complete? Would they have to like trade everyone on the roster in order to do that?
Yeah, for the realistic possibility, if they wanted to sign two max players, because that's what comes up a lot, is to acquire one of them via trade. So, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr., I think, is the one everyone looks at because he's making around $18 million. He's not an old player, and he does play, you know, he's a shooter, right? Like, maybe he's not, I paused at saying pure shooter because we've seen him have his stretches where he doesn't make a lot of shots. Yeah. But the point is, he's a guy, it's not like you're taking someone like Noah who you think, you know, he doesn't really fit anywhere. So that's why it's hard to trade him. I mean, Hardaway Jr., for a team who isn't able to attract free agents but wants to, you know, still have a young player on their team, well, 2 years of $37 million to have Tim Hardaway Jr., which is what it would be past this year, that's not, you know, that's not a bad asset. So maybe they could do something where they feature someone like him to acquire someone like, if it was Butler, an example, and then they still could also have max space, but then they, beyond stretching Noah, they would have to move, for instance, someone like Courtney Lee without taking money back. They'd have to do some more movement on the roster, to do that.
Seems basically impossible to me. What kind of odds would you put on that? Nothing's, you know.
Yeah, well, especially because I think a lot of people would say, like, is that, you know, is that the player that you, I don't know if a lot of people want to trade for him in particular. I think if they were if they were making that movement again because they know it's Kevin Durant coming, then obviously you just do whatever the hell you got to do. But to do that, like, let's say they did that, they got Jimmy Butler, and then they used him as, like, the bait to get a second guy, and then the second guy turns into, like, Kemba Walker, who, by the way, I don't want to say this saying I don't like Kemba Walker, but I'm just saying it's not Kevin Durant. I, you know, then I'm kind of like, yeah, we're – you might end up having to sacrifice a draft pick or a young asset to get that second max space, and if you're doing it without getting – one of these like legit superstars, you know, I don't know if I like that as much.
Any sense on, and this is probably just coming from your gut, but if the Knicks will be able to get Noah to give any money back in a buyout in a post Luol Deng society where he gave back, what was it, $7 million?
Right. He gave back $7.5 million. So I think everyone's like, okay, maybe that's the standard. To me, it comes down to Noah. Obvious, you know, he's been promoting the fact that he's been working out, and not to get back into the workout videos, but there is, you know, this is all part of the business of the game, right? It's these are out there because not just so, you know, people like me can share them, you know, just for ha-has. It's so they can send out a message. This guy's in the gym. He's working. He wants to play this year. So, you know, I think he has incentive to give back some amount of money so he can then go to a team where he thinks he, you know, fits better and maybe resurrect. And when I say resurrect, it's not saying like he's going to go and be an all-star again, but at least like he's not this guy that's been an outcast on a team and is not even on the bench, you know? Like,
yeah, for sure.
So to me, like, you know, and I guess, again, not to get into the math, the crazy math of it, but remember these players, like if he signs a minimum deal somewhere as a 10-plus year veteran, you know, that's about $2.4 million. So if he thinks he can make a minimum amount over the next couple of years on the team, then at least that amount usually players are willing to give back because, you know, they're offsetting it, some of it, in their new salary.
It just seems if he really does think he has so much left to give, it's interesting that he wouldn't be willing to give up some money sooner to get with another team. And I know that's like, I'm sitting here, you know, not having potentially to give up $5 million of my own money or whatever.
Right, right.
But
right.
It does seem like he's truly confident. Is it a matter of he has all the confidence in the world in himself, but maybe understands that other people don't, and so it's just the prudent play, you know? And it's almost like these guys, I feel like you have to have so much both rational and irrational confidence in yourself to make it to the NBA, because look at the odds, right? No matter how good you are, it's just astronomically difficult to get there. I guess I'm saying I'm surprised he's not more irrationally confident and it doesn't show up in contract negotiations, but maybe it's just having an agent.
That's part of it. And again, you know, we're able as fans to kind of look at the, you know, we can crunch the numbers and we can look at rosters and weigh all these things. Obviously it's a lot different when, you know, you're the person making that decision. I mean, I know for myself, right? Like if I were to take, you know, I remember like coming out of college, deciding between like a couple of jobs out of college. And it's like, you're weighing, you know, all sorts of things. And imagine someone from the outside trying to tell you what your best decision is. So, you know, that's part of it too. But one thing, actually, I'll throw one question at you on your own pod. But I mean, how do you feel in terms of, okay, let's say he gives back, let's just use that $7 million number, and then they stretch out, you know, the rest of his contract. Are you on the side of, this is ridiculous, why are they rushing it, just wait and see, maybe they can trade him later, and now we got this longer cap hit? Or do you see it as, you know what, there's probably nothing else they can do, I want that 2019 cap space, so just go ahead and do it?
I waffle on this all the time. I will say that for the longest time, I was 100% staunchly like, you just do not, you know, buy out this guy. You don't stretch him at the beginning of the season or, you know, after September 1st when that deadline was, because what's the point? You don't know if you'll be able to sign someone, blah, blah, blah. But the more I talk to people about it, the more it does seem like it's one of these things where you can never know 100% what's going on behind the scenes. Right. And if he is like this bad presence or whatever, and if they can like use that, I guess where I'm really at right now is I think it would be crazy to stretch him without getting him to give back any money at the beginning of the season. Cause it's like, I'm sympathetic to you wanting to get all the money you made. You signed this contract. You're supposed to get $18 million. But, like, it is what it is. You're not part of the team's plans. So, like, you can either, like, chill out on the bench and collect your $18 million or pay a little bit of money to leave. Like, and if he's being reasonable, I think he should get a little bit of money. I guess your question was more about, like, what should the Knicks do? And I think my answer is it's almost impossible for me to say without having all the information that they do. But if they have come to the correct conclusion, let's say, that there's no healthy way to integrate him into the team whatsoever, I think I'm slightly okay with it now if they are able to get him to give up some money. Not because I think he owes it to the Knicks or anything, but because I'm worried about their cap situation.
I think what you're saying is funny enough, it's sort of how my mind has gone with it. And maybe why this cap stuff matters to me is my original background is in economics. So my mind always kind of thinks benefit cost and whatnot. To me, it's like, yeah, it sucks they have to stretch, that it depending on how much he gave back, it could be like 5 to 6.5 million that they have to stretch. But let's say we even followed the logic of they waited out and they said, and they see what they could do with him as an expiring contract next year to trade it. There, to me, there's not one asset on the Knicks roster, because I don't know what right now we would call their least valuable asset that another team would want. But, like, I'm not trading Mitchell Robinson. I'm not trading, you know, Frank. I don't think another team's going to do it for Damian Dotson.
Yeah.
So even if you took a draft or even a draft pick, let's say it's a protected draft pick in 2020, is it really worth giving up when you hope you're a competitive team, the 20th pick, when you're going to probably be capped out? Because if everything goes to your plan, you've signed a max player, you're going to be capped out, and the only way you add to your roster at that point is going to be late round draft picks.
Yeah.
Is it really worth that to save $5 million? In that year? Probably not. That's probably the biggest part that's turned me, besides the whole, you know, where he fits in the locker room, and, you know, that's definitely a component too. But from that kind of economics view of it, I'm like, I just don't see what they're ever going to attach to Noah, even if they wait a year, that is worth less than that cap hit that's stretched.
Yeah, I think that's right. And especially if they get him to give back even like $5 million, right? And then it's like $4 million a year. It's Ron Baker money, you know? So it's like, and the cap's going up, it's less a percentage of it. So that's kind of like swayed me. I can't tell if I've just been beaten down by the fatigue of the story. As someone who covers the Knicks, I'm like, just get this out of here already. It's hard for me to separate.
That could be it. I mean, we're all waiting. When it comes, every single Knicks account, you know, get ready for that free throw that he airballed, because we're going to open up Twitter, and obviously we won't see it in sequential order because Twitter won't allow that. But in 2 days from after they buy him out, you're going to see everyone's tweet about him airballing the free throw.
Oh, my God, you are. It's funny. My most honest answer to this question is when September 1st rolled around, I woke up every morning being like, did they stretch him? Looking forward to it, even though I've been very against it. It's just, I don't know. You're programmed, that 24-hour news cycle. You need stuff to happen.
That's it.
That's it, you know? Okay, so I want to talk about your work with As Knicks Film School on Twitter. But before we do that, just want to remind our audience that you're listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Network, your team every day. So, JB, for me, and I think for a lot of people, I became aware of you as Knicks Film School on Twitter last year. I feel like last year was sort of like the year that account blew up. I'm not even sure how long you've been around as Knicks Film School, but like there was sort of this mysterious aura to you from me when you showed up. I'm like, who is this guy? He seems to have a very, you know, like well-thought-out plan of attack, gotten all these things doing, but I'm... You know, most people aren't, you know, overnight successes, so to speak. So I'm kind of curious what, like, has been your path to Knicks Film School. Like, how did you wind up here? Like, what have you done, basketball or otherwise, that sort of, you know, has found you in the position you're in today?
Yeah. It was, I guess, maybe June of last year, so a little over a year that I started it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my basketball background was just growing up, you know, playing basketball, but I did that through high school. I never got to a point that I played, you know, competitively or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think really my story is is about, I guess, mixing basketball with what I'll call technical skills more than it is anything else. And it's funny because now since the account has grown, I get a lot of people reach out to me that are younger and maybe they're going into journalism or whatever. And I think they see me as an example of some, you know, average fan who is able to, you know, grow a large following. So they'll ask me advice. And what I always tell them is, like, to me, I get, you know, right now we have that great Nike ad right now to Nike ad out right now about, you know, be crazy enough to follow your dream, etc. For me, it was, I built up a lot of, I'll call them technical skills. So meaning video editing, you know, Photoshop, graphics, stuff like that, that then once I have the passion of the subject, which is the Knicks, I could then apply all of them to the passion. So it's almost like I went the boring route in school in my professional background of getting all the skills. And then the passionate part is the topic. So now I apply those skills to the topic. And I think really that's what's served me the best, is that I don't really have to rely on anyone else to do much of what I'm doing. I pretty much everything that's come out of that Knicks Film School account has literally just been me. And, you know, that might, like I said, sometimes be a graphic. It's obviously a lot of videos, but all that, you know, I'm able to do myself, where I think there's a lot of people that know more about basketball than me, and there's a lot of people that know how to use those individual tools better than me. But I think I've been lucky that I know both of them enough that it creates, you know, kind of what it's created.
You're like the Twitter version of Ben Falk.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but yeah.
I know you have other designs too, not just Twitter. And one of those is this project you're working on, KnicksFilmSchool.com. Wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what we can expect this coming season. I know you've been like teasing some things. You've been building this huge empire of collaborators. What do you got cooking up over there?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you know, we've talked a little bit offline about that. But yeah, the idea is just, it'd be cool to have a site that, you know, can be sort of a community mixed with a place where we can have a lot of the stuff I've put out on Twitter in a more organized way. Because unfortunately, I think, like we all realize with the Twitter app, it's really the best, most terrible thing that we use every day. So I was just like, you know, I want a place, like, I think a lot in terms of, I'm a Knicks fan, what are tools or what are services that, like, I would like to have? And I think of it more in that way than I do, you know, I want a blog to write about the Knicks. I think about it as, I want a place that gives some sort of like value or a tool. So the site is really focused on that idea of, it's going to have, you know, some articles and analysis, obviously, but it also, I'm hoping, is a place where fans can come and it's like, I can get all my Knicks news summarized really nicely right here. I can find, I have all these questions about the salary cap. I can go, it's going to be there, it's going to be presented in a way that hopefully is easy to understand, and I can get it there. I want to know about, you know, the Knicks schedule. You know, I can go and not just look up when the Knicks play, but I can also see, you know, how many back-to-backs are they playing? Is the other team on a back-to-back? How does that impact things? So it's just kind of taking these questions or these things that we would want to do as a fan and trying to create a site that gives you a place that you can go, you know, easily find it. I think maybe one other use case example was when, before the draft, all the workouts were happening. You know, the Knicks, you know, you get all these reports that just kind of dribbled in about, okay, the Knicks are working out this guy or they're working out that guy. But there's no place you could go and see, all right, just tell me all the guys they've worked out. So I, like, I have an idea, right? And maybe a site would put together a post and do that. But then by the time they write 10 more posts, it kind of gets buried at the bottom of the page. I think there's things we can do on the site that's a little easier when timely things like that come up, where you can just come and it will just be very obvious where you find that information. It'll always be there. It'll always be updated. I guess that's to give you some examples, but of the general idea of it.
No, it's very exciting stuff. It is interesting how many things that you would think there would be like a really nice looking database for that just doesn't exist. I mean, maybe, I don't know how many people look this kind of stuff up, but anytime someone talks about like someone's injury history, I try to cobble it together by Googling, and there's some resources out there, but it's really, you can't just like click, like go to Basketball Reference, click on Kyrie Irving and be like, how many games did he miss with like what injury? At least that I haven't been able to find.
Yeah, right. No, that's a good point.
There's like that. There's one I wanted to see, like records of like fines and suspensions. There's just one database that I go to that's just like a Word document that's 1,000 pages long that someone's been keeping track of for like 12 years. But I think there's just a lot of opportunity for people to kind of like put things together in a nice, comprehensible way that other people haven't done before. So when you talk about like off-season workouts and that kind of thing, or you know, leading up to the draft, I should say, that's definitely some stuff that I thought was good that you were putting together earlier on with Nick Swall type stuff. And I look forward to seeing more of that at your future endeavor.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about something you tweeted the other day. This is a little bit more lighthearted, although we haven't really been too serious, but I was shocked to my core when I saw that you were obsessed with Blood Orange. Not that the you know, otherwise known as Dev Hines, the recording artist. Not that like you wouldn't be, but I don't know. I guess like I it just seemed like so, you know, so much about the salary cap, and Blood Orange is so soulful. It's, you
know. How could this possibly? Yeah, how could they have this possibility? Well, no, it's funny because, you know, growing in my hometown, I grew up where hip hop was very prevalent in the '90s when hip hop was blowing up. So,
where are you, from again? Are you from Connecticut also? Or?
Yeah, so right outside of Hartford.
Okay.
And, you know, it was kind of almost the reverse where me being the nerdy white kid who likes salary cap stuff, mm-hmm. I was actually kind of the minority. You know, we have just a great mix of people in my hometown. So mm-hmm. That really helped expose me to different kinds of music. Because when I grew up, my dad was a, you know, a hippie. He literally was at Woodstock in 1969.
Oh, yeah?
So he was, you know, he taught me about, you know, still great music with the Beatles and all of those bands. But then, you know, I think through going to school, you know, getting exposure to different types of bands, maybe that's where in groups, that's where I got kind of this, soulful taste. And then once you hear that, you can't stop listening to it. But with Blood Orange, like I said, it's funny. Like when I'm making these videos, like, I don't know, they in particular, I just love like putting them on in the background.
Uh-huh.
And there's just enough like changes in the way the arrangement is made. And it's not like you're just listening to like, okay, here's a verse, there's the hook, and then it's repetitive. It's like there's just enough there that, I don't know, it's like, you know, some people listen to Mozart or something. I listen to that when I'm working.
Is that your exclusive playlist, or do you have a couple things that you cycle between?
Yeah, well, if I'm doing like video stuff, it would be that, or it would just be like, you know, just like those playlists that play just like background beats or something.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I just can't concentrate. Like if I hear a song that I know, I'm going to start listening to the lyrics and then I forget what I'm doing. So it's got to be something that I can kind of put on, but it's not too, you know, familiar in a weird way, because then I'm, you know, I'm not paying attention.
Yeah, if it's something new, it like can't have words or I'm completely distracted. But then I get in these weird loops where I'll listen to an album I know well like 1,000 times in a row. This past summer I was working on the My GM story mode for NBA 2K19, and which just came out. Get it if you haven't already. And I listened to Prince's Dirty Mind like 1,000 times in a row. It's
okay. Yes.
And I'm not even like a big Prince guy, but for some reason that album I'd heard a couple times. I'm like, I like this. And it had enough of like a kind of just like, it was steady but with enough changes to like keep it interesting and not be a complete, you know, monotonous drone. And that just like, I literally listened to it like 300 times while writing the script for the My GM mode.
Okay, so yeah, similar type of idea then. And yeah, it does definitely get you to think a little different, because I think, you know, it's like they say when you're driving in the car or in the shower, like you need something that distracts you enough that it allows your mind to kind of wander, and that's obviously good when you're trying to create stuff.
For sure. I want to wrap up this conversation by, I'm starting to take sort of a straw poll about how good the guests on the show think the Knicks can be this year. And when I asked that question, I'm talking like realistic ceiling here. Like, I don't want to hear about, you know, if angels come down from heaven and dip Kevin Knox in the river Styx and making him indestructible, except for his heel. I'm talking like realistically speaking, you know, like KP misses at least half the season, doesn't come back in MVP-ish form right away. Because I think some of this is, maybe this is like a very, I'm like coloring how you answer it before you even do, but I see a lot of people say like, well, if Fizz gets the kids playing defense and blah, 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 blah. And I just don't see that path where they could win more than like 35 max. But I'm curious what you think about that. Is there a more realistic path to being like a 500 team this year?
Well, no, I think you said it right. I mean, especially their schedule to start the year, you know, is a little more difficult with the amount of road games and whatnot. And I think, to me, if KP was, you know, a shooting guard or something, and but he was their main scorer, and they lost him, but they still had, like, you know, like when they used to have, say, Tyson Chandler or someone else who wasn't their main scorer but played anchored to defense. The fact that he is gone and he really anchors that defense, and then you're playing guys like Cantor a lot of minutes, and you have a young team that is learning how to play. I don't doubt that Fizz will have them playing hard, and we know obviously what guys like Frank can do, but you're still a young team learning basically a whole new scheme, and you're learning, you know, how to do things. There's going to be mistakes. So I think the combination of not having that anchor in the middle and not and having young guys that are still learning a new system to play on defense, you know, could make it difficult to roll out of the gate with a lot of wins. I think they'll play hard, and they'll have games where these guys just score enough that, you know, they'll win some games. But I think that's why, you know, when you say like 30, 35 wins, I think that's realistic. But the exciting part is, like we saw in Summer League, I mean, I remember covering all those Summer League games, and I remember always being like, if someone told me the next morning, did the Knicks win or lose, I couldn't even tell you, because the whole hype and the whole conversation was just like, oh, Mitchell Robinson blocked another shot, or Knox did this. Like, I just think the excitement this year is going to be so much around like what those guys do that, you know, in a strange way, they could almost win 40 games, but if those guys had like pedestrian seasons, there would be less excitement than if they win 30 games. But there's like this real sign, like, okay, it wasn't just Summer League hype. Like, these guys are legit possible pieces that they somehow found in the same draft. That's what's going to create the excitement. But I think your expectation is about the same as mine, you know, in terms of wins.
Yeah, I'm the most excited that I've been for a season, I mean, since KP, easily. It's just, and it's not tied to, people are like, well, if they show signs, shouldn't they win more than 30 games? And I think they could look like great rookies, Knox and Robinson. I think Frank can look like he's made a step forward, and they could still stink. Like, I think they could still have a super bright future and stink this year, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, I guess the only question that could come is, so if they somehow stay above water, and then we hit February, and KP does come back.
Yeah.
Now the question is, I mean, Mitchell Robinson, I think, especially, you almost might have to put him to a side. But, you know, are these guys at that point when you could argue, all right, now they could make a run, are they hitting a rookie wall? Or are they able to get through game 60? Like, if these guys weren't so young, then maybe you can make the argument, okay, just stay above water, KP comes back, and maybe you get this run, game 60 to game 82, where they are suddenly like just a really, really good team. Even that, I just think it might be tough to expect, you know, rookie players to, you know, to perform on that final stretch.
Yeah.
But that, again, could be fun. Like, that to me is like, they could literally be out of it. And that's where we're going to get in a ton of Twitter debates about, you know, the value of getting a draft pick and all that. But that those last 20 games, if KP does come back, and the team has now played together for a while, that could be a pretty fun time no matter what the win total is.
Oh, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, even though KP promises to be a little bit rusty coming off a torn ACL. The one variable that, like, could swing this a little bit, you know, I don't think they're going to, like, become some playoff team with this, but is, I feel like, Frank Ntilikina. I just, like, what does it look like if he's fully empowered by a coach? in year two if they play him down the stretch when they need defensive stops instead of, you know, a Jared Jack. And that's where I'm like, but I still think Frank's going to be like pretty good on offense. He obviously has a very long way to go, and I could see him not making too much of a stride there this season and still having a bright future ahead of him given how young he is. But like, if he shows a little bit more there than I thought and is the defender than we thought, that's when I'm like, maybe they sneak out a couple more. But
I think that's true. And he's the classic case to me of there's always going to be these, you know, extreme opinions about him. I hope in a way he's a good example of someone that, by the fact that, you know, on NBA Twitter, we're a little better of identifying things like they do on defense, that people see more value than it used to. But I just think for Frank, he's more that player that hopefully when the team is good, let's say as soon as next year, he's that, like, you know, I don't want to throw like Derek Jeter because he's on his whole nother world, but, you know, that type of guy where he's just, when you're a winning team and you're watching them every day, you're like, oh man, there's so many little things that he does that we couldn't replace. But you can't just expect him on a team that doesn't win a lot to, I think, show out that, like, oh, he's this like star lottery pick. That's just not, I don't think that's what he is. You know what I mean?
No. And it is funny because there, like you said, there are so many people on Twitter who I think are very knowledgeable basketball fans. There are a lot who are not, but there are very many who are. And so I say things like, yeah, I think Frank's going to be really good. He does so much on defense. And then, you know, a lot of people agree with you. And then every once in a while I wander into like a corner of Twitter and it feels like I opened the wrong door in a nightmare and everyone hates Frank and they're like, this guy's trash. He's washed forever.
Yeah, no, that's like, where I get, you're asking about criticism. That's where I actually get the most. Because it is true.
Is it?
I, you know, pump Frank a lot. And part of it too, you know, as people hopefully realize, is I try not to just create like clickbait. Obviously, I'm doing a lot of detailed analysis, but, you know, I always think of it as sometimes you're putting out a meme, you know, it's kind of like you're paying the bills on the account because you know that stuff's going to fly. And with Frank, it's just so funny. I mean, you could literally put out anything of him, especially last year, and like it would fly. All these people would go nuts. So maybe you start putting more than you should. And because of that, there is this underbelly that follows me that's just like, oh, you just love Frank and he can't do any wrong. And, you know, I think based on their perspective, I guess they could get that. But
there's a need to kind of evangelize for defense because, like you said, a lot of people miss that and it doesn't show up in numbers well. I think there is a tendency when there are players like this who a lot of people who don't watch them every day don't see everything that they do, that the people who do enjoy them feel the need to pump them up more than if they were whatever other homegrown talent on their team, right?
Right, exactly.
It's like, this is an important thing that people need to understand. But, yeah, okay. I feel good. I think we covered a bunch of interesting topics on today's episode. I want to thank you so much, JB, for joining us. Why don't you let the people know where they can find you online one last time, and if there's anything you want to plug, let us know.
Okay, great. No, yeah, sure. Obviously, it's Nick Film School, not Nick. Sometimes people mix that on Twitter. And then, yeah, just look out for the website. And then hopefully this is, you know, the first of many. I'm excited to be on the pod.
Yeah. I just got to say, Ashwin and Alex, JB told me that he's going to dethrone you guys.
I'm coming for you guys.
In DM. Right. So just watch out. You've been warned. All right. Thanks again, man.
All right. Thanks.
That's it. Thank you guys so much for listening to Locked On Knicks. If you got a moment, rate us on iTunes. Every rating helps. 5 stars, please. Subscribe to the show if you have not already. Tell your friends about the sensation that is Locked On Knicks if you have not already. We want to grow our audience, and word of mouth is a great way to do that. Do your part. Don't be a jerk. Why do I make it that way? Oh, I'm sorry. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On Knicks for general camaraderie and bonus takes, or at NBA Injury Report for jokes and jokes and jokes about basketball. Be chill to each other. Spay and neuter your pets. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Only salt the pasta water. Take that for data. Biggie's better than Tupac. Peace.